Welcome to Cultimatum, the podcast uncovering the dark realities of cults and human trafficking. I'm your host, Anonymous Andrew, and each week we dive deep into the manipulation, control, and courageous escapes that define these worlds.
And I'm Melody, Andrew's co-host. Having experienced the depth of a cult firsthand, specifically the House of Yahweh, I am here as an advocate for fellow survivors.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests are their own and do not reflect the official policy or position of Cultimatum or its affiliates. The content discussed on this podcast are based on personal experiences and should not be construed as factual or legal advice. Neither the host nor the guest are liable for any statements made during the episodes. Listeners are encouraged to conduct their own research and seek professional advice where appropriate.
And before we dive into today's episode, we want to issue a trigger warning. Some episodes may cover explicit and potentially disturbing subjects such as sexual abuse, rape, human trafficking, suicide, and other sensitive subjects. Listener discretion is advised. Hey, Cultimatum fans, before we dive into today's episode, we need a tiny favor from each of you.
That's right. If you love what you hear, please take a moment to rate and review us on Apple and Spotify.
Your support helps us to reach new listeners and bring more awareness and attention to these important topics.
So tap that star rating, drop a quick review, and help us spread the word. It really does make a difference.
Thank you so much for tuning in and for your amazing support. We truly appreciate each and every one of you. Now let's get started with the show.
Here we go. Welcome to the Cultimatum Podcast, the culture of cults and human trafficking. And my name is Anonymous Andrew. And we have a very special episode for you tonight. We have the siblings of a cult called the Children of God. Today, Melody and I are joined by six incredible survivors, the siblings who escaped the Children of God cult. So we have Michelle, Gabriel, Celeste, and Natasha. And there is also two other siblings, Andre and Eduardo, and they may or may not join us. We're waiting for them to connect, but we decided to get started. And I think Eduardo may be joining us. So I'd like to thank all of you, first of all, for working it together to come together on one evening. I know you're scattered throughout the country. We got some in Hawaii. We got some in Tennessee. You're all over the country, all over the Northern Hemisphere. And so thank you very, very much for joining us and making time for this. All right, Melody, you're up.
I'm just going to do a quick introduction that the Children of God, or the also known as the Family Cult, was founded in the 1960s by David Berg. It was notorious for its extreme control, exploitation, and disturbing teachings. All of you guys grew up in this environment, and today we're going to dive deeper into your experiences and what that was like for you inside of the group, and how you left and where you are today. I'm going to start with a question for Michelle. Can you describe your earliest memory of being inside the Children of God?
I remember large homes with a lot of people that came and went, a lot of singing, a lot of Bible study, and sleeping in rooms with maybe 8 to 10 children my age. So those are the first memories I have from the cult, being in the cult.
Andrew?
Yeah, I'm here. So, all right, I have a question for Gabriel. However, here I go off script. I thought that maybe we should tell the audience who the Children of God cult is, because there's absolutely no information on here. Can I read the first paragraph off of Wikipedia?
Sure.
Yeah, because nobody knows, if people tuning in may not have any clue who the Children of God are. And I think it's important that they know, because everybody took their time to come on here, who the Children of God, which cult that is. And so I'm just going to quickly read, and then I'll ask the next question. So the Children of God is also known as the Family International. Am I correct? Okay. Was that more their name, or when did the Family International come on scene?
They received a lot of persecution, and they changed their name to the Family, and then the Family International. I would say sometime in the 80s, probably late 80s.
Okay.
Like that, yeah.
The group was founded 1968 by David Brant Berg, And the group has gone under a number of different names since its inception, including Teens for Christ, the Children of God, or COG, the Family of Love, or simply the Family. And then it goes on to say the British court case found the group was an authoritarian cult which engaged in the systematic and physical and sexual abuse of children, resulting in lasting trauma among its survivors. The group has been accused of targeting vulnerable people. And it goes on four or five more pages, and we'll leave it at that. And I guess we'll find out more about all of that through our questions. So, Gabriel, as one of the older siblings, do you remember when you first realized your family was part of something unusual or different from the outside world?
Well, we had the distinct impression from just talking to our cousins and just knowing, we always knew. Right? We had somewhat contact with the outside world. The outside world was called the system, and we were in the family. So there was a concerted effort all the time to make sure that we knew that we were in the select group of people and that we were special, very special to be in the group, and we should strive to do our best and stay in the group by adhering to the group's teachings. That was very, very, from a very early age, we knew that. And that was always instilled in us. Like, yeah, you guys are special. You're here. You want to stay here. You got to follow with this and that. And yes, absolutely.
Well, and just quickly, because I didn't go through the rest of Wikipedia. Where was the cult based out of?
They were at some point, well, the high leadership, the top, they were in Tenerife, Spain. They were in Japan. We knew because we got videos. So a video would come in of, you know, a bunch of kids jumping around. And so, you know, in Japan or somewhere, they were moving around a lot, although it was always kept secretive. We never knew where the
elders,
the leadership was at any time, because they were always in hiding.
So I'm going to assume that there was a chapter in Britain, because the British court got involved. So they must have had a chapter or a cult in England somewhere.
I think at the height of what they were doing, they were up to 12,000 people worldwide, which means pretty much every country in South America, every country in North America. They sent people to China even. I mean, in the side of trying to get God's word, let's call it, out there, they were very busy and very active in that sense. So they were always trying to do things. Like when my dad talks about being in Argentina when there was a dictatorship, you know, so it was prohibited to talk and try to talk to people about Jesus. They were special, you know, in the 70s, 80s, they were intense about that. And they would, their followers had to adhere, like, hey, you got to go in the middle of nowhere and do this. And they would.
I have a quick question. I'm just going to make an assumption here. I'm going to skip my other question because Michelle already answered my other question. But I'm going to assume that some of the reason that leadership was moving so much and in hiding was because of the child abuse that was going on. Maybe they were trying to avoid law enforcement. When they thought law enforcement was maybe getting close or figuring out what they were doing, would they move? Is that kind of the reason that there was so much movement in that part of the group?
They were always hiding. They were hiding all the time. Like they were constantly moving around and hiding from police, from social workers. When the Pope would come around Brazil, then churches would always, you know, they were always in hiding top. And then they would get sued and sometimes get arrested. Not really us where we were at, but we would hear of it, and we would get publications. From the time I was like 10, I remember that happening, like 8 to 10. I remember there being in Brazil. Yeah, we heard waves of that. And so the top leadership, they were always in hiding.
Michelle, you raised your hand.
Yeah, Melody, you do have a point. They were in hiding because they would get a lot of accusations, and people would go to the cops and, you know, anonymous calls. Anytime anything like that happened, or they had like a disgruntled member that would leave and be very unhappy with the way they were treated or how things ended, the authorities would come looking for them. Anytime that the authorities knew what was happening in the homes, they get persecuted. And that's the reason for moving so much and hiding. And it was top secret where they lived. We never knew where anybody was.
So Celeste, one second. You were all living in Brazil while you were in the cult?
Yeah, we were.
Okay. All right, Celeste.
And because of that, it's the reason why, for example, I don't have any pictures of me as a baby. And when I ask my parents why, they say because we had to move so much and pictures had to be destroyed, evidence had to be destroyed, and I don't remember that too much, but we would have to leave in a rush. So I don't have pictures of me as a child. My parents had to get rid of everything each time that we had to move in a rush to somewhere new.
So pictures were allowed?
We have some pictures, but not as many as a normal child, for example, because we had to get rid of them a lot of times. And most of the pictures we have are because my mom sent our aunties pictures, and our aunties outside the cult kept our pictures. So when we left, they gave those pictures to my mom. But we don't really have too many pictures of us in the cult. Very few.
Melody, you want to gear up?
No, actually, your next question is to Celeste, because Michelle already answered the one.
Okay. All right.
And Andre's not here.
Just to the audience, we have questions on a script, but we're going to go off script from time to time. Okay, Celeste, the cult's doctrine focused on isolating children from the outside world. How much did you know about the mainstream society while growing up?
We were aware there was a mainstream society because we had to go sometimes out on the streets and sing, and we would preach the gospel to people in stores and out on the streets, And also we had our cousins that we had limited contact, but when we did have contact with them, we knew they lived different than us. But I don't think we really, really knew how different people lived, how different than us people lived until we left. We were extremely sheltered, and we couldn't watch television. We couldn't listen to the radio. There was no outside world influence in our day-to-day lives. So we knew there was another world, but I don't think we knew that. The extent.
To Natasha, since you were so young when the family left, what are some of the things that you learned about later on about the cult that shocked you the most?
Oh, man, a lot. So, well, actually, the thing that shocked me the most was that they had this thing called flirty fishing, because, you know, the cult was really big and those houses needed to be supported somewhere, somehow. So they used to send the women from the cult out to bars and stuff to, you know, seduce those guys and the big executives into the cult and into supporting them. I think that was my biggest shock, is that they kind of did some, I would say, prostitution, you know. And then also in our personal family, it was to find out that my father had children outside of the seven of us. I guess so. And also the free love thing, because they have a free love thing that they could, you know, they could all sleep with each other. I don't know. I guess I didn't realize that because I was so little. But after I left, I think that those were one of the things that I was. That's just not.
Natasha, I have to go back. And this is one of Andrew's rogue moments. What? You just said that they would send women out to the local bars to recruit members to come back by sleeping with them. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Yeah, Gabe is shaking his head. Yes. Okay.
They'd also get donations from these men. So they always motivated these women to go out and meet very influential men, doctors or, you know, dentists, lawyers, so they could also help support the cult. So not only did they want more people converted, they did that a lot for money and, you know, goods.
But it's valid to say that those women that, you know, were recruited, they were regular moms and regular, you know, they were regular people during the cult. They weren't just designed for that. I don't think so. They were just regular, and that was their mission.
But if you were married to a man and you had a family, one of the elders would come up to you and say, we need more people in our city, in our cult, so I want you to go down the street to the bar and sleep with a man. So she was commanded to have an affair. Is that fair to say?
Well, our dad was in that situation. Disculpa, Natasha. Yeah.
It's just, you know, a lot of the things that happened, for example, as I said, my dad has a I think it's only two kids out of the marriage. A lot of the things would happen. Let's say I'm married to you and some other girl was there. She was lonely. She wanted to hang out with a guy, but I was jealous of you. I didn't want to land you. So we would go to the leader and he would be like, but Natasha, you have to land him. Love isn't selfish. God isn't jealous. So, you know, they were all sheep. So they all got kind of like corroded into it. How do you say it?
Yeah.
That word. Yeah, so that's how it was. But remember, they were all just in a cult. They were all sheep. So,
but just for clarification, that was amongst cult members and also with outsiders. So they believed that God showed his love through sex and that they incentivated couples to split up and show God's love to other people. And then obviously, you know, go outside of the cult for donations and whatnot with
and,
other.
I assume this is you in the chat. Is that you, Gabriel, that commented that it wasn't just the women who did the flirty fishing, it was also the men? Did you want to speak on that a little bit?
Yeah, because the men, you know, that were good looking and were outgoing, they were coerced into getting women into the group too. So it wasn't just the women. Yeah, on both ends. Outside, kind of what Moses David preached. You know, one of the things that he got really, they received a lot of persecution for was their ideas behind sex and God is love, love is sex, God is sex. And so he would get into that in a big way through his publications. And he took a lot of heat for that. The group took a lot of heat for that. But that was a regular practice until at some point in the 90s, they said, no, this is not worth the trouble that it's causing us. And they kind of stopped doing it. But for a long time it was. And not just with the women, but with the men too. Like our dad was a good looking American guy, musician in Brazil. So he was a guy that was a high value guy, was sought after by women on the scene. And he was a bar musician. So he would play in clubs and bars and whatnot. And that led to a lot of infidelity, which was condoned and promoted by the group. So it was like, my mom had seven kids already. And it was like, no, you have to put up with this because this is good for the group.
Okay. I knew this was going to happen. I got to go back. You called him Moses David. Yeah, because when I read from the Wikipedia,
his name was Grandpa. David. His name was Grandpa. They called him Grandpa most of the time because he's as old. You know, I only saw pictures of him really after we left. Nobody knew. There was drawings of his face. Nobody had seen his actual face, but he was like this bearded guy with these bugged eyes kind of. And he was in his 70s. I think he died when he was 75. But they always called him Grandpa or Mo or Moses David.
And when he passed away, somebody filled his shoes, the cult kept going.
Somebody married, his second in command man married, you know, what they called Mama Maria, but her name is Karen Zerbe. And, you know, and they continued.
So one more question and then we'll go back on script. What, you said your dad was American. What was your mom?
Her mom's Brazilian.
Okay. So you're half American, half Brazilian. Okay. Gotcha. Okay. Where are we, Melody? Oh, it's my turn. I guess this question to Michelle and Gabriel. As older siblings, did you feel a responsibility to protect the younger ones from the more harmful aspects of the cult? So I'm guessing you saw what was going on. Did you feel protective of your sibling, your younger siblings?
Absolutely. Being the oldest one of all of them, one of my biggest anxieties growing up was knowing that they were being physically abused or just hit by anyone. And there was absolutely nothing I could do. And that was just, there was no way to protect them because my parents weren't around much. They were always out preaching or trying to recruit more members or, you know, what they called witnessing, getting more people to come to the cult. And a lot of times our educators or our handlers were not the most loving and gentle people. So we were disciplined a lot. We got hit a lot. And there was a lot of physical violence growing up. And watching my siblings go through that was really awful.
I guess on my end, no. I was kind of the one getting mishandled. So in general, no, I didn't think about anybody else too much. I mean, me and my brother, André, were two of the ones that were getting disciplined the most. We were cotton is behaving the most. My sisters tended to be on the more behaved side, so I don't remember them being disciplined much at all within the group, but definitely me and Andre were getting a lot of discipline, so I wasn't too worried about them, no, but I was...
Why do you think that is? Why do you think the boys in the family got disciplined more than the girls?
We were more prone to doing things, right? We're more physical. We would fight each other, would break things. We were prone to just, yeah, more active. And the girls were always more behaved. They were doing...
We were scared. We were really scared. I behaved them all the time out of fear and not for the right reasons. We were terrified because we saw what they did to the boys. We saw our brothers get beat, you know, like no child should ever go through that.
Obviously, yeah.
We were really scared. So that led us to behave.
Well, and in any situation, if you see somebody else being beaten or abused because of something they did, that will keep you in line because you know that you're next if you do the same thing. Yeah. It's kind of makes logical sense.
I'm going to go off script here a little bit too, because I could see that Natasha was getting a bit emotional about some of this. Natasha, is that some of that because you're just now learning some of the ways that your older siblings felt protective of you? Or do you want to share some of why that's emotional for you?
It's emotional for me because from all of the four sisters, I'm the only one that has children. And I feel so bad for Michelle that was her childhood because she really didn't have a childhood. And as a mom, obviously, I think I get more sensitive because it was stolen from her, you know. Like, besides having to take care of us because she had to, she was the oldest. And, you know, a lot of our changing our diapers, bringing our milk, it was all left to her. And on top of that, she had to worry about all those things. And obviously, since she was, I'm sorry.
No.
That's understandable.
It's just my sister lost her childhood trying to make sure that we would have something. That's...
Well, what was the time frame? Like, what? Try to give us an idea. From 19 what to 19 what were you actively in the cult?
We left in 92.
Okay.
And I was born in 81. Shelly was 79. Our parents were in there a while. My mom got in there kind of not much before. She got in and she got pregnant with my sister soon after. But my dad had been in there already, I think, for, I don't know, 8 years, 7 years.
I have a personal question. And of course, feel free to say you don't want to answer this. Are all of you from the same mom and dad? You are. Okay. No, because I don't know if, like you said, your father was told to go out and sleep with somebody. I don't know if he had a child with that person. So they would then become your sibling.
We get that question a lot. When we say we're seven, people are like, same mom, same dad. So, yeah.
Okay. All right. And I'm glad the answer is yes. I felt like if I asked that question, it would open up a wound. And I was worried about that. So, okay. All right.
Let's skip ahead to number 10, Andrew. Skip ahead to number 10.
All right. So this question goes out to everybody. Looking back, what were some of the most effective methods the cult used to maintain control over the families?
Yeah, let's go.
All right, I can go. A lot of what was used was that, you know, if you left the group, you'd be out in the system and the wolves were out there and the world was very not your family. And that was used on the kids a lot. And then the parents, you know, because they had it structured, like not everybody had to go out of work. Everybody had a job, but they had it structured like, oh, if you're good with kids, you stay here at home with kids. If you're good with sales, well, you go out and witness. If you're a good, you know, so they would make it, okay, if you have to be out there, then you got to be surviving and you don't have the warmth of our family home, which is how they would talk about themselves. You know, you have this family home, you have all your family here. But that was the main one. And then another one was also they were always moving the goalposts around. Like this was the standard, but then tomorrow, you know, God could change the rules and make it like, hey, you got to be more earnest and you got to be a better follower and you got to want Jesus more and you're too cold. You got to be hot for Jesus. And so it was always getting moved around. So people never knew if they were behaving, because you could be behaving today and tomorrow, like, here comes a 2x4 to your head because you're not, you know, you're not following Jesus's guidelines. And these would come from Moses, from the leadership. They would put out a letter that was put out like every 2 months. And that was the maximum, like, that was the word right there. So, yeah.
So, Celeste, go ahead, Celeste.
Also, I think the one of the biggest forms of control were by isolation. We weren't allowed to see our family very much, maybe once or twice a year. And everyone we knew was within the cult. We didn't really have contact with the outside world. So that's a form of control.
When you say your family, you mean grandma, grandpa, aunts, uncles that were not part of the cult?
Yeah, that were not part of the cult, but very, very limited contact. One of our uncles was gay, so they made him seem like a horrible person, and he was a sinner, and he was a child molester, and they would say all kinds of horrible things about him to us. They were very extremely, what's the word?
Homophobic.
Extremely homophobic. We were taught that.
So you're telling me that they called him a child molester, and yet they were practicing that very concept?
Yeah, exactly. They would tell us that gay people, it was a sin, and they were child molesters, and he was a bad person. Meanwhile, they're the ones doing it.
Wow. A lot of projection going on there. I'm just going to throw that out there.
And we're going to go to Michelle in a second. Melody, how many times have we heard this, that they tell you that the outside world is evil?
Oh,
right?
Yeah. No.
And if you leave the cult, you're going to go to hell, and you're going to die, and you're going to catch cancer. And this is what I'm hearing from.
No. And that was, my cult was the same. And yes, and almost every guest we have that comes on here, that is one of the main control tactics, is fear of the outside world. Absolutely.
Also, how many times have we heard that they changed the rules along the way? Like, they, if something didn't fit their agenda, they would. So I think Gabe said that things would change. So Gabe, these letters that went out every 2 months, were they like different doctrination? Like, they would change the rules or change the behavior? I'll get to you in a second, Michelle.
So the setup was that we were being trained as the end time missionaries, right? The end time Christians. And so leadership let us know what the devil was up to, and also what God was telling us to do to counter that. So this was the constant game. It's like the devil's always trying to get you, right? The devil's always at you for whatever reason, your weaknesses, the devil's always trying to get at you. And so their updates could be like simple things like, you know, you're using too many rolls of toilet paper to take a shit, or could be anything within the home dynamics. And also, you know, be it, and some things made sense, like, hey, always walk out of the house two and two. If you're on the street, be, so some of it was sensible, just from, you know, perspective of you have a bunch of people living together. Others were very manipulative, and, you know, you can't wear a certain kind of clothes. You can't obviously say certain things. That we didn't have any cuss words at all. Of course, no drug consumption. Alcohol, they allowed like wine here and there for communions. But I read a lot about the leader. Like, he liked sherry. He was a drunk. So they had like letters about Moses, David, like going on a sherry binge. And it's like, you know, I'm the king. The king has a heavy crown, all these kinds of things. So yeah, there was that was the setup, was that God, and he was the mouthpiece of God. And then, yeah, the wiles of the devil. And they were always giving us updates on how to do that. And that meant anybody get chopped off for any reason, right? Because you never knew what you were doing wrong until they told you. And then, by the way, yeah, we've told you this many times, this much time has gone by, so you're no longer fit to be in our elite Christian group.
Go ahead, Michelle.
Another way they controlled specifically the women is by threatening to take their children away. So,
yep, we've heard that before. Yeah.
When my mom was not okay with my father going out and having this 8-year-long affair with this woman for her donations, they isolated her from us, and we didn't see. She had I think she only had the three of us. She had me, Gabriel, and Andre. We were very small. So they sent her to another home. She didn't have access to us for weeks, and that drove her insane. So from that point on, she knew that she had to collaborate with the cult and keep her mouth shut and let my dad, you know, sleep with whomever he wanted so she can maintain her kids. And that's really, really disturbing to know.
Celeste, I'll get to you in a second. Natasha, you're really having a problem with this.
Sorry, it's just because I'm a mom. My mom had told me the story, and she said that at that time, and she was pregnant, by the way. She had the three of them. She was pregnant with Celeste. And she told me the story, and she said that she couldn't take it anymore because it was too much. She had realized by that point, you know, that it wasn't right. And they took her kids away. And she says that for 8 weeks, she was without us, and she was trying to fight back and to get us. And then one of her friends told her, if you love your children, just say yes and go back. So I cry a lot already, and I'm a mom, and I always think about this going through me as a mom and my children. I apologize. It's just, please, you know, and it's,
you don't have to apologize. No,
there's no reason to apologize, Natasha. I hope, if nothing else, that even though this is emotional and difficult for you, for me, being a fellow cult survivor, I hope that this is healing and also part of your healing journey for you, and that getting some of this out and making this known and helping with bringing awareness is also helping to heal you as well.
Yeah, I think so. For a long time, I think we were all very embarrassed of this experience in our lives because it has everything that is not supposed to have. You know, we didn't have choice, but
Natasha, and to everybody, remember, you didn't have a choice. You were born into this. So it wasn't like as an adult at 20, you saw this organization and were recruited and decided to join. You are literally victims of this cult, right?
Yeah.
Celeste, you wanted to say something?
Another form of control that I can think of is forbid any kind of birth control.
Oh, of course, because they want more children. They want more offspring.
Yeah, and my mom had seven, but there were women in there with 14 kids or more. My mom was always breastfeeding one of us, and then her other arm, always breastfeeding another cult member's baby because a lot of women didn't have milk and my mom was like a cow. So my mom, I remember her always with two babies, always breastfeeding, always, always, always pregnant women, a lot of babies, a lot of children.
My next question is going to be to Michelle. By any chance, because you are the oldest, did you start to question the teachings before your parents even chose to left? Because I know you left because your parents decided to leave or were kicked out. I guess we can get into that at some point too, but maybe you can answer both of those questions.
When I was a very young kid, I kind of told my cousins and my very conservative aunt the sexual things that happened in the cult, because for me, it was normal. We were brought up with that. And my mom got into a lot of trouble. And that's when my mom decided to stop taking us to my aunt's house and to my grandmother's house, because word was getting out. Oh, yeah. I knew it was wrong. I knew wrong things were happening. But in our mind, we were so brainwashed to think that we were God's chosen people. And we were so special that was just the price of being in God's chosen, you know, fold. So when we left, I actually remember crying and being devastated and promising myself that I'd go back. They said they'd accept me back at the age of 16. I left when I was 13. Thank God, within 6 months of leaving, I realized how messed up that place was, and I never wanted to go back. But up until the day we left, I was really sad, and I thought that was the only way to live.
Okay, so you saw the writing on the wall, that phrase. Gabriel, at what point did you see that there was another way of living outside of this cult? So you're the second or third below Michelle?
Yes.
Right?
Second.
So Michelle, you're talking about your mom, you and your mom were going to your aunt's house.
Right.
Did you consult your siblings about this?
My mom would take us to our aunt's house on a regular basis. When I was very small, not all siblings had been born yet. There were only maybe three or four of us. And I was very small when I told my cousin, you know, I just blurted something out very sexual. And that's when my aunt was like, how does this child know this? And I started telling her everything. And I got in huge trouble with my mom. My mom said, you never tell anyone anything. And that was another form of control too. They controlled us kids to where we could not say a word. If we told an outsider what really happened inside the cult, we'd get spanked. Like there was no, that was like the ultimate betrayal for them. We couldn't say anything. But then once this happened, my mom realized that we were, you know, little humans starting to talk and realize things. So we were no longer allowed to go to my auntie's house. And when we did go to my grandma's house, we were supervised. We weren't really left alone with my outside family. We were just very, we had to be under their thumb at all times.
So Gabe, at what point did you start to, I guess I'll go back to the term writing on the wall, when you started to think something's not right here?
When we left, I think maybe because we were, for the last 6 months of us being in there, we knew that my dad, we were in a home that they sent people to, like a last chance home, in a last attempt to recover or reform whatever attitude or behavior that the person had. And for my dad, that was his temper. He had a really short temper and he would lash out mostly at his kids. And to the group, that wasn't good. So they sent us to a home. We were there for 6 months. And then after that, went back. We were on our own for a bit. And our parents told us that we were our own for a little bit, but that we would rejoin. And then I think maybe 6 months in, I was sitting with my dad and he was like, yeah, we're not a group anymore. And I think I was like 13, 12 or 13. And I was 13 and I started to cry. And I was really sad about that. But we didn't know right away that we weren't in the group. None of us knew until a bit later, because our parents were struggling just to, you know, we started going to regular school and my dad was struggling to make ends meet. He was a musician. All of a sudden, he never had a profession, a career. So he started to play gigs at night on the weekends and he started to teach English in English schools. And then they broke it to me. And then, you know, kids are adaptable. I never had like a moment of breaking down and crying. Just when he told me, I was really sad. But after that, it was like, you know, it just kept rolling.
Okay.
So I'm going to move to the next question, which is for Celeste. I know
Natasha has her hand up.
I missed that. So
I just want to make a quick remark that the only requirement to get into the group was that you didn't have HIV. You could be a rapist. You could be a killer. God forgives it all. But don't have HIV. So that kind
because
of
Because that
you.
Was associated with homosexuality at that time.
Yeah, because they were having sex with everybody and with children. They didn't want a group full of HIV. You know, that's what I think.
Right. So. And this was back in the 80s when HIV was very prevalent. It was everywhere. So, all right, Melody, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, that's okay. I didn't notice that. Thank you for observing that. I was looking at my paper. So my next question is going to be for Celeste. I know since your parents made the decision to leave, do you remember if they tried to explain to you how they made that decision, or was that something that they didn't really explain to you guys why they left or how that happened?
To me, my parents didn't do much explanation. We just kind of followed. They didn't tell us what was going on. And I don't know if they have shame or what, but I just remember overnight we're leaving and we're in a bus stop waiting all nine of us for a bus, and we went to the bus cross country to be at my grandma's house. She took us in like overnight. We just were homeless essentially, but there was no explanation. My parents didn't tell us. It was just like as it was happening, oh, we're leaving. To this day they haven't explained much.
I think.
Are your parents still alive?
Oh yeah, very much so.
Okay. And where are they living?
In Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Good for them. Okay.
I think because I was the oldest, I got the full explanation of why we were leaving.
Oh.
And I was never told the lie of we're going to try to come back. Like I knew that was it when we left. And I knew all the financial struggles. My mom, my parents, they leaned on me heavily to keep my siblings calm and to take care of them. So I was one of the adults. I knew how much money they had. I knew how much money they didn't have. I remember worrying how we were going to pay rent when I was 13 years old. It was really awful.
Did they have any of you work? Because in some other cults, we've seen children having to work. No. Okay.
No.
Well, work was yes or no. Like as kids, when we were in the cults, they used to make us go and sing at stoplights and the grocery store and clothing store and then be like, oh, we have all these kids. We're Christians. So I think we worked. I don't think we didn't work. I think that's work.
In the cult, yes. In the cult, we had to.
Yeah.
So
also, we were made to do a lot of chores, cleaning. Like they would inspect our work. And if we left one speck of dust, they would make us clean again. And we had to work.
We
definitely
were never catered to. We were never catered to.
I think what I'm referring to is more like on some of the cults that we've heard that they grew their own food. So they would be out in the farm all day cultivating the crops. So was there any of that? You lived in Brazil. So I know I've been to South America and I know a lot of families grow their own food. They grow corn. They grow their own food.
We weren't cultivating the crops, but for example, they lived on donations. So if they got a donation, let's say of 20 boxes of apples, they would line the kids and we would all be like cutting the apples. If there were rotten apples, we would cut the rotting pieces out. We usually got donated things that were about to expire. So a lot of our job was to clean these foods to make them appropriate. So yeah, we didn't pick our own vegetables, but we helped them. We were part of the working in the house to make it all function for sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Andrew, I have to jump off the call.
Okay.
Is there any question or two that you want to shoot my way? I need to jump off.
Well, I guess the only thing I would ask you quickly, it is a question here, and we do ask a lot of our guests this. After you left the cult, Eduardo is joining us. Okay. After you left the cult, how did you learn to deconstruct and integrate back
today?
Into society? Where are you today?
That's a part-by-part kind of answer, but I only talked about it 10 years later. It took a long time. I was only able to, I had a girlfriend who had been raised in a kibbutz and she was a journalist. I met her like in Brazil and then I started talking to her about my life. And then that's when I was able to, I told her the story. And yeah, only 10 years later. So we got out, I was 13. The only time I started talking about it to somebody was 10 years later. And it took a really long time to digest. And I guess not until my 30s even, you know, so it might have taken like the better part of a quarter century to just the whole, like, digest it. And then, yeah, it's still, I would say I got it out of my system already, but not till kind of recently.
And where are you today in your faith?
Today I'm back to growing and thinking straight and just like I got back into my learning and just having my mind on rather than being, you know, this happened, all this stuff, my life is like this because of this and that. And now I'm back in, like, my brain switched on, I'm growing, I'm growing my business, I want to start a family again. So a lot of what happened there, I've been able to use to my benefit and the things that, you know, just like I got on with my life, but not till only a few years ago, really.
But do you identify as a Christian?
I can't say so, really. Like, I probably yes, but not in a church-going way.
Okay. Common answer. Yeah, no. Very common answer from ex-cult members. Okay. Very good. Gabe, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to jump off.
All right.
Okay. We want to say thank you to the Gross family, at least the Gross family. That's their last name, by the way, that showed up for this half of the interview. But stay tuned. Eduardo does end up showing up. And so stay tuned for the second half of this interview with the survivors of the Children of God. Very interesting interview, very unique. And for as chaotic as it was, it went better than I thought it would with having that many people on, Andrew.
Yeah, and hopefully with the editing, it won't sound as chaotic.
Yes.
I do. So to the audience, this will be a two-part episode. The recording went to an hour and a half, and of course, that's enough for two episodes. And at one point, we had four or five of the siblings on, so there's a lot of information. And of course, Andre were supposed to join us. Andre is in Hawaii. Maybe he couldn't get a connection. Eduardo was also in Hawaii, but he does join us. He'll be in part two. So come back for part two.
Stay tuned.
You want to hear that part.
There's more to the story. Yes, there's some funny parts.
There's a funny part in part two that you want to hear. Yeah. Okay.
Yes, it is for sure. So thank you for watching, or for listening, I should say, to part one. Thank you for all for tuning in to Cultimatum. Your support is always greatly appreciated. And if you enjoyed today's episode, if you could just take a moment to rate and review us, especially on platforms such as Apple and Spotify. And don't forget to follow, share, and keep listening to all of our latest episodes.
You can also connect with us by joining our Facebook group, The Cultimatum Podcast, where we dive deeper into these important topics.
And you can also find us on additional social media platforms such as Instagram, Pinterest, TikTok, YouTube, and Threads.
If you have a personal experience with cult or human trafficking that you'd like to share, reach out to us at cultimatumpodcast@gmail.com.
And if you are an ex-cult member looking for any additional support, you can consider joining the Cult Escape and Recovery Group on Facebook.
And if you'd like to hear more from me, you can check out my other podcast called Digital Dating with Anonymous Andrew, available on every platform that there is. If you'd like to help us with the cost of maintaining the podcast, you can show your support through the Buy Us a Cup of Coffee link in our show notes. There's an opportunity that you can donate anywhere from $5 up. And every little bit helps in our mission to spreading awareness about our cults and human trafficking.
And as always, stay safe, stay informed, and remember, you are not alone.